Broadcasting live from the Village, this is the Monstrous Feminine podcast, the film club where we dissect the eerie intersections of gender in horror. My name's Mila and I'm joined by my shadow puppets,
Louisa,
Taya,
and Zeba. This is our second episode of the month talking about folk horror films. We will be covering the 2018 film Impetigore, directed by Joko Anwar. Before we get into the film, go ahead and follow us on Spotify, YouTube, or the Apple Podcast app. You can find all of our links on our Instagram at the Monstrous Feminine Podcast.
In Impetigore, a young woman named Maya and her best friend Dini travel to Maya's ancestral village to claim inheritance of her grand childhood home. Maya knows little of her past, having grown up with her aunt in Jakarta after the mysterious death of her parents. Upon arrival, Maya and Dini soon discover that the small community intends to kill Maya, believing her and her late parents responsible for a devil curse that has plagued them for years and causes every baby in the village to be born without skin.
Guys, have you ever went back to your hometown and found out something very strange about your family that you maybe didn't want to know?
You know, I haven't, but I have a plan to, and I'm gonna execute it.
Would you go and investigate? And I know that Zebra and I would, and I know that Louisa and Ty wouldn't. That is the divide.
Yeah, I would throw some money at the situation and like get a lawyer to go do it.
I'd be getting up in it.
I mean, it depends what, like, if it was like, I mean, this film is so specific, but I guess if it was somewhere where I deemed not like spooky-ooky, I would go.
If it's from a relative I've never heard of, it would be like on The Sims, where you get like those phone calls and it's like, your great uncle left you a mysterious thing, but you have to do this task, and they never say anything, you just kind of get the money. You're like, they don't have relatives. I just made them and created them. So anytime it would feel like that. And I would just be like, if I don't know them, they don't exist to me. I'm selling this, taking the money and never looking at it.
Oh no, I'd be investigating. I would.
I'd want to go see it. But I it depends. I think what you're saying, Taya, is valid in that if it's like haunted vibes, then no.
The Monstrous Feminine is on SoundCloud, so please go listen and comment. If you do engage with our content, you might just get a shout out in our next episode as our Witch of the Week. This episode, our Witch of the Week is Jacqueline Joestar, who commented on our Baby Jane episode and said, "Excellent episode. Listening to y'all gives me peace. Peace." I like that verbiage. Horror is not a peaceful genre, but maybe they're referring to the soothing, dulcet tones of our voices. And
again, not my vibe. Maybe Taya, for sure.
They didn't want to single anyone out, so it was fair to all of us, but we know what they mean.
Thank you, Jacqueline, for leaving a comment on our SoundCloud. And you left a few comments. I just happened to pick this one. So thank you so much. We love when people engage with our episodes, and that is like a surefire way for us to see your thoughts on the films. We check it, we screenshot it, and we send it to each other.
Friendly reminder that we are also on Patreon. You can find all of the information about our tiers on our social media. Please support us. Any contribution helps.
So, the background to this film is that it premiered in Indonesia in 2019 and then internationally in 2020 at the Sundance Film Festival. And then it was acquired by Shudder to stream internationally. And it was a box office success in Indonesia. And it was selected as the Indonesian entry for the Best International Feature Film at the 93rd Academy Awards, but it wasn't nominated. But at the 40th Citra Awards, it got, which is Indonesia's top film honors, the film received a record-breaking 17 nominations, and it won 6. And it went on to be the biggest winner at the 2022 Indonesian Film Festival, which was the first, and it was the first horror film in history of the Citra Awards. So it's very highly acclaimed. What did you guys think of this film?
I think it started off really strong and it fell apart in the third act because I think the payoff for the reveal was pretty not much. It's like a very weak payoff for a lot that it puts you through in the film. I don't know. It wasn't my favorite.
I think I probably enjoyed it more because I the third act, it like shifting a bit in terms of, I think, like the momentum it had built up, like I didn't mind so much. I think because it like established like a really strong characters in the beginning, especially like the friendship between the two leading actors, I think that I kind of was like willing to go through whatever because I really liked them. Yeah, I think that I liked how like succinctly they kind of like established their bond. It felt very natural and very funny, even obviously this very dark film. But, and I think like stylistically the film is very strong, and sometimes that can kind of carry it, like where like maybe Ty, you were going to develop on like the story or the plot kind of dissolves a little bit like in the third act. I mean, it's a longish film, and I guess that's sometimes difficult to maintain. But for example, there's other films that like I think that if it's I have a strong reaction of like not liking them, then I don't know, it's just very, it's so clear where I stand. Like this, I'm just like, okay, interesting film, good film. I really like the performances. I like the folklore elements. It got a bit batshit insane, but I kind of like vibed with it. Even the end, I read before like that people really hated the end, like the sort of time had passed. It was a year on. It didn't inspire any really negative feelings. I just sort of had a good time.
I thought it was scary. And I think that is rare for me. Like, not in that, like, it's not keeping me up at night type of scary. Like, I don't think I'm going to find myself in a situation like this. It doesn't, like, bring about any, like, subconscious anxieties or fears that I have. That is often the thing that I'm like, oh, like, this stuck with me. But with this, I just like the pacing, at least of the first two acts, was really well done for me. I think it starts when she's in the toll booth and he's coming after her with, he has like a hammer, a machete, like he's coming after her with a weapon. Like that whole kind of like cold open situation was like very sort of like anxiety inducing for me. Just like, that's when I sort of was like, this feels like it was made by somebody who watches a lot of horror, who knows like what beats are like exciting and like how to stretch those scenes out. I think there was generally that the main character was always either ignorant of what was going on around her or that people were actively after her. I think that like sense throughout the whole thing, and it starts from like the very start of the film. So like people are actively after her. Strangers are just like wanting to kill her. I think that like she's not a scream queen because she had to stay real quiet about it. But like, I don't know. I think that sense felt very like commercial to me, and like what is appealing about commercial horror as far as like thrills and chills and like just keeping me sort of engaged in that way. But it's not like the plot of it, and is definitely folk horror, definitely sort of like has that like international appeal, that indie appeal, but like the beats of it felt very I don't know, like regular big box office smash horror movie to me. Like that just like, oh, it has the thrill of a slasher, but it's not a slasher. And it has the thrill of a supernatural horror, but it's not entirely like the horror isn't entirely driven by the supernatural elements, right? Like the ghosts aren't the ones after her. It's the humans. And that is always more scary to me than the devil is after her or whatever. It's like it's people's choices. And I think that the plot was really driven by people's choices long ago, people's choices in the moment, how they're deciding to like handle things, like that, all of those, that like fickleness of people's personalities causing such like turns in the plot was like really engaging. So I agree that it does like fall apart in the first act, or the third act rather, because like, I don't like the way that the information is revealed to her through that like psychic seizure that she has. And I don't love the suicides feel like out of like left field. I'm like, whoa, why are you reacting in this way? It feels like this like weird panic response. Like, I don't know how to like absorb that. And then also this sort of like 1 year later, the 1 year later thing also felt very commercial to me, like the way they set up a sequel. But that aside, like I gave it passes for all those things because those are passes I would give like an American like Blumhouse feature film if I was scared. And I'm like, my question I ask myself, I'm like, was I scared? Was I excited? Was I engaged? Yes. So I'm like, I liked it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think it had a good, like, what you touched on, like, tension building and those, and, like, moments. One thing, and it's also, it was just so, like, I know it's going to sound another stupid, annoying film person word, but it's so cinematic in the sense of how they set up the shots. And, like, I really like the kind of red hazy fog. I like the kind of wide angle scenes. I love the learning about Javanese shadow puppetry and, like, watching those sequences. I thought that was fascinating. And I just thought it had great, like you said, tension. The kind of beginning scene when she's not actually in the village yet, but when she's just in the clothing, like, stall market and, like, it's deserted and there's, like, you know, the mannequins and stuff. I was very tense the whole time. And yeah, so I thought it was, like, it did a lot with that. And I thought it was really interesting. And yes, I was scared. I did have a little bit of trouble. I think the characterization for me wasn't really there. I had some troubles understanding. I don't mean in the sense of, like, Maya and Dinny. I think I understood their bond and whatnot. Like, that was actually done quite well. But what I mean is I just don't really understand a lot of the characters, like, motivations for doing things. And also, like, there's some bits where kind of in line with, like, almost like a Halloween franchise-esque slasher is, like, how they do be doing stuff of, like, what are you doing? Like, at the beginning scene in the toll booth when she is, like, she doesn't think to shut the window. It's always, like, the last thing she does. And when she opens the window, and then I don't understand why she actually leaves the toll booth. Like, he has a machete. It's going to actually be quite hard for him to, like, sling it through the window to slash you. Like, you could pick something up inside the toll booth and, like, try to bend his arm off. You know, I didn't understand what the motivation was for getting out the toll booth. So it was kind of, like, almost, like, a big American franchisee of, like, pick up a weapon or what are you doing? And that, like, frustration, though, also felt, like you said, Zeba, almost very commercial to me of, like, ah! So it did, yeah, I kind of didn't really see it as, like, maybe somebody who's seen a lot of horror movies making a horror movie. But yeah, I guess it did have that kind of central frustration. But also, like, when I didn't understand their motivations even. Like, I know we've said, like, oh, she didn't realize that her ancestral village hated her. But I mean, the guy told her in the very first instance. I don't understand why she thought that'd be a safe place to go. I mean, she was attacked by somebody from her village. It's a leap to then say, everybody hates me. But I also think it was naive as fuck to be like, I'm going to just rock up and claim a house and no one's going to have a problem with it, right? Like, I'm just, that'll be cool, right? So I was like, really? I just think it lacked a little bit of, like, common sense there. I mean, it did a lot to say, like, obviously they need the money, like, they're running out of money, that, like, inheritance is, like, a strong motivator. But for me, I was still a little bit like, what do you mean? Like, why are you surprised that people want you dead? A guy came after you with a machete. Did you not think that was weird? And then when she, like, unwraps that weirdly well-preserved scroll in her leg, she's, like, surprisingly cavalier about that. Like, she's not freaking out, really. She's just a little bit, like, intrigued. I was like, I would be panicking. Like, what the fuck is that in your leg? I just feel like sometimes, like, the characterization just in terms of, like, believable reactions or, like, common sense was lacking for me, which made it a little bit
hard. I would have called y'all first. I would like, you would not believe what I found and where it was.
Yeah, I don't know. So I just, yeah. And it goes beyond that. Like, even, like, the kind of ending films, like you mentioned, the suicide, Zeba shocked you. I also was like, you've had 2 seconds to sit with this information in your first, like, reactions. Well, we have to kill ourselves. I was like, what? I didn't understand why the new puppet elder, Zeptati, like, killed Maya's, like, quote-unquote father, but not real father, the original puppet master. I didn't understand. Was that just, like, for the ascension of power or because they thought he'd killed the 3 girls? So they were like, it's revenge. I don't understand. I didn't really understand that motivation. I didn't quite understand why the grandma was, like, so, so evil. She's cool with letting every single baby in the village die to protect her secret. Like, damn, that's, like, cold. Like, I don't know. It's insane. It's cold. I think I struggled with it. And also, it felt a little bit incongruent because, you know, obviously it said that her son, the new puppet master, was born from rape. And then she resents her son for having an extramarital affair with, you know, Maya's mother. But I don't understand why that then makes her so, so angry that she must curse the baby. And also, I don't know. I didn't really quite understand her rage, like her female rage. And it seemed to be like the central motivator in the film. And I wasn't quite, I mean, I understand, sorry, the rage coming from the rape, but I don't understand the killing of all the unborn babies or the spite against Maya, because her gripe was with Maya's adopted father. So why is she angry at her own grandchild? I don't know. I was just very perplexed because she also seems to love her son. So it's not like she resents her son as you might like a child born from rape. I don't know. So I was very confused. And I think like that is why it didn't always hit for me. But in terms of like a watch and like, you know, frightening, I liked it. But yeah.
Whereas you maybe didn't like the sort of more... The elements that felt more commercial in a sense of when, I guess, like we're using commercial as a sort of synonym for this sort of Hollywood-y blockbuster slasher type feel, which definitely makes sense as our like comparison. I feel like it's hard to always think about non-Western films in that binary because as well as having obviously their own like national cinemas, like so much of Hollywood imposing their dominance was through globalization. Because of that, like naturally the filmmakers of those places were inspired by like the sort of excess of content that was coming from Europe and Hollywood. So that's why you like, see so much sort of like of these eclectic styles of a mix of this sort of blockbuster with the sort of more like local filmmakers like styles and genres. And we talked about this a bit with, I think, Train to Busan, because that's like really prevalent in Korean cinema. So yeah, it's hard because you don't want to have that kind of like binary lens of, hey, these are the elements to me that felt American and Western, and these are that felt a bit like, oh, I'm not sure I understood that. And that's not to say that just because something doesn't make sense that it's like because you're being like ignorant towards that place. For me, actually, I kind of liked the merging of those sort of more slashery kind of nonsensical, like why is she opening the window? Those elements, like it did have a little bit of humor and it felt more fun. But then I think because it, like me personally, like the folklore and the sort of strange, intense family trauma in history felt for me grounded enough that like I didn't really mind that those two things were sort of happening like simultaneously. But what Zeba said about like the supernatural elements, apart from the sort of like flashback that's obviously like brought on by these three spirits, like the supernatural elements are quite subdued. Like for the first two acts, like all of the horror is sort of brought about by the opening scene with this man who just attacks her. And then when the best friend is killed, like the two guys who lead her, you know, deeper into the forest. I think that so much of the horror of this film is basically, it felt like very, this could slot into one of our, you know, as a men episode for that alone, because it felt like you said, Zeba, like this is not really playing on unconscious fears that you might expect like from folk horror that's, we talked about a bit with The Wicker Man, that was this sort of like blurred line between local folklore and paganism and versus a sort of more civilized, quote unquote, society that developed into, and like the tension between them and the cultural anxieties around that. But this sort of had very clear separation between what was happening with the family and then these scenes that felt like they had no kind of supernatural basis. It was just like men, just men. Which, and then I think, like you mentioned, the grandma being the big baddie at the end of it, completely, like, purely evil character. For me, actually, even though it was predictable that she comes in and she slits her throat after, it kind of suggests that she's going to set her loose when she's the best friend's hanging and they're about to like sacrifice her. It's obvious that she's going to kill her, but it still like plays with that like expectation of like, you know, this this maternal figure is going to be the one that shows some kind of empathy. And I know that's nothing necessarily that innovative or new. I think I just enjoyed the way it was sort of like using some of these tropes, but kind of to tell its story in like an interesting and fun way. But I don't know. I think that I get like some of it not being as coherent as I think it could have been, especially because the motivations, they seem quite random, because it's sort of just this grandma who wants to like continue on her deception of cursing this child. And so it felt like one person's maybe cartoonish evils. So I get that. Like, it doesn't necessarily have like the grounding that might feel like, therefore the third act is satisfying. Like, all the reveals come and you're like, that makes sense. Like, at least I have some kind of understanding, even if what they did is horrible. Like, there's a sense of melodrama to it for me. And I don't know enough about like Indonesian film or theater, or if like that's a style that's like popular there, but it did have that sort of sense to me. Especially when they like both commit suicide. I think it just kind of reminded me of in countries where family shame and like pride is like huge points of contention. Like, if deception is sort of revealed, I don't know, maybe that's why it made sense to me.
I mean, she definitely couldn't have, like, they would have killed her. I think once they realized what she had been doing and, like, for how long and what the consequences were, like, she was not long for that world anyway. And I think she knew that.
It was just, like, how, it was more like how quickly he accepted that truth. Like, because, like, obviously it came to Maya and, yeah, because I don't, it's not so much that I don't, like, you know, disagree with the notion of like family shame or outcasting and suicide being the option. It's more of like that they do it so quick, and I was like, whoa, okay. Because Maya obviously learned that truth via like the ghost coming to her, which I don't even mind that flashback scene, honestly. This all the critics are like giving that a lot of flack. I don't care about that. I thought that was fine. I don't mind it, but it was long, but they interspliced it, and I thought that was also kind of tension, so I didn't even mind that like whole sequence. But I just mean that, like, he did not have ghosts come to him and reveal the truth of the situation. So he was just taking her word for it. And not going to lie, like, if I was hanging upside down about to be sacrificed, I'd be lying. I would be lying just to get out of there. So the fact that he didn't consider she might be, obviously she wasn't. It was more like just how quickly he was like, Mom! Like,
he maybe knew some part of him and therefore was able to accept it really quickly.
You've done a lot of assuming there.
I mean, presumably she wouldn't know, like, about his relationship with her mother, though. So for her to pull that out of her ass, like, obviously she would have to know some context of what went on larger.
But he has had his memory wiped, so he also wouldn't know the truth to even verify that she's telling the truth. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but that sounds like something that she wouldn't know. So I think if someone said that, I would be like, my interest is piqued. You have my attention.
Okay, interesting.
Fair enough. He could have sat with it for a little bit longer. I think that what Zaba said about the like unconscious fears not being as tapped into worked for me, maybe, because it sort of did seem like a look how evil humans can be kind of film. And I didn't think I minded it. Like, it was, it kind of was a bit chaotic in a way that it just clicked with me. I didn't really know.
I think this movie is a castrating mother movie. Because she has like this idea of a certain amount of control, and the control sort of leads her to castrating the entire village and completely halting their ability to have children. And just because she like does not get what she wants from her son and is able to like control who he loves, and in a way they have a very weird Oedipus complex, but it seems like it's more so from her end than his, which I think we don't normally see in horror, where like the mother has an unhealthy attachment to like her son. She's giving boy mom on Instagram.
Zeba and I like gasped at that.
But also, like, what I didn't understand is how the grandma then like comes back and consumes the baby at the end, because there was no curse in place that should be allowing her to do these things. I think that is where I was like, okay, you're losing me. Like, the suicides happened really quickly. And it seemed like she killed herself more so in response to her son dying first, like him killing himself. And then she was like, I can't live without him. So now I want to die. I don't think she would have actually cared that much about the villagers trying to kill her as long as like he lived.
Wouldn't that make a batshit spirit though? Like that, it made sense to me.
Yeah, but like also she just like just get to become like a evil, angry little ghost or something just because of that.
That's such a mild way to put it when she's consuming a fetus straight from
the womb. Yeah, evil, angry little ghost. That's like knocks over like a glass off the shelf, not like consumes unborn fetus.
But like she's somehow like transcended from being like an absolute evil woman killing all the babies in the village. Now like in the afterlife, she's consuming the children, but there's no curse, and the curse was like overdrawn because she put the spirits to rest. So I'm just like, how did that happen? How is there like a new way that the babies are dying in this village? Because how do you even make peace with her? Her gripe was not even with Maya. Like, what is the solution to this new issue?
She's just got mad beef, like, simply can't be placated.
I'm not saying I've met mothers-in-law, grandmothers. Nobody is as evil as she. But sometimes people just, like, have gripes because of the whole boy-mom thing. Like, they seem irrational.
Okay, one of my criticisms I now take back, because I think that actually frames it a lot better for me as, like, what was the grandmother's motivations. Because I was like, why did she care so much about her son having an Maya's mom having an extramarital affair with her son? And I realized if she's obsessed with her son in a kind of Oedipal way, then that would make sense why she'd then be so angry and maybe take out on the mother, like punishing the mother by punishing the baby. That kind of resolves that issue for me. I do wish maybe there was something showing how she was a bit more obsessive in that like back lore thing that would have like made it like more obvious to me, but I accept that. I think the point about her being a castrating mother, quite literally like no one can have babies, is like genius, a reading of it. And I also think she is quite like obvious, another obvious one femme trope is that she's the witch, right? Like she's just over here casting these curses like nobody's business. So she's a very witchy figure. I don't really mind the end where she's consuming fetuses so much. Again, that's another bit that gets a lot of like dragging from the critics. Because I think only because in the film, the sympathetic villager, I think her name is Rati, the pregnant one whose husband was the one who originally attacked Maya with the machete. Like, she says at one point, like, a curse can never be undone or reversed. It only gets transformed. So I kind of just viewed the grandmother coming back and consuming fetuses as the curse is not reversed. It can only be transformed into something else. I mean, it is a bit bleak.
Could they not just like go outside of the village to have the child and then that wouldn't happen?
But then we lose the folklore element. It's the connection to the land. Anyone who's like from there is fucked, essentially. I do think this film is interesting in terms of examining it of folklore elements, because you do have the kind of isolation, kind of in the sense that it's like a secluded village, very insular. You do have like, obviously it's like, you know, in the woods. You've definitely got some skewed moral beliefs, and then there's definitely a lot happening. And so as per Adam Scoville, who's a folk horror critic's like folk horror traits categorization, I think it definitely fulfills those. But it also offers like an interesting one, because like we've talked about with folk horror, it often involves like students coming in and trying to like learn about a land. And it's interesting that they use that as like their ruse to like go into the village. And it also plays with like insider-outsider dynamics, because obviously Maya's from the village. So she actually does have like a claim to be there. And that's interesting. But then also it renders her like the ignorant character, like we said, like she's kind of going there for almost like classist exploitation of like, you know, I'm gonna sell this house I don't even know if I technically own and get the inheritance. But also like there's definitely like a cultural divide, like there's definitely like a separation from her culture of origin. City village vibe, like she doesn't speak Javanese and she's like a bit estranged from her, like, kind of upbringing in that way. Obviously, because she had to evacuate. I'm not trying to blame. But yeah, so she's kind of like the kind of ignorant, she still remains in that kind of key folklore tradition of like an ignorant outsider, but then it complicates it because she's also an insider, but then it also complicates it because she's the target of everybody's like malice. It's quite an interesting one for a folk horror. And I do like the kind of, in terms of folk horror incorporating like local legend, the kind of inclusion of shadow puppetry was really interesting.
I wanted more puppets though. I feel like I was expecting at some point for like the puppet show to show me to like be like prophetic in some way, like to like play out the story, and it never took the opportunity to do that. Again, they want to be Candyman so bad, the remake that had the puppets, the shadow puppets.
Yeah, I agree. That would have been excellent. That kind of almost Harry Potter-esque like switch would have been cool. I guess they incorporated it into the like the lore in the sense of like using the skin of the victims. In fact, in an interview during a panel at Deadline Contenders International, the director said that when he was 6 years old, his brother told him that the leather used to make shadow puppets was constructed of human skin, and that stuck with him and acted as like inspiration from the movie. So just like your brother dicking around.
Is that not folklore? It's, yeah, comparing this, for example, to the Wicker Man, where I think that the folklore was, it seemed more so like the kind of axis of horror. Whereas I think in this, obviously, the axis would be more about like the human motivations, like the grandma being a fucking evil bitch. And then like everyone else, like from her sort of manipulations, becoming these, you know, doing really atrocious things in the name of like saving your community. But I think that the story was told through the folklore. I don't know how, apart from maybe the skin, like the shadow puppets being made out of human skin, and then Maya needing to be skinned in order to reverse the curse. I don't know how much of the folklore became a sort of source of horror. It was very much like a character study rather than, it didn't always feel as generational as like, it seems obviously generational because it's about like a curse that lives on for a community. But I don't know. I think that in the end, like it does, a lot of the fear and horror and certainly a lot of the like gender politics of the grandma, it falls on her as this like this central figure. And then at the end, like we're left with this really very burned into your mind type of image of her like gobbling on a fucking baby. So I think, I don't know, it's, and this isn't me trying to argue that it's not folklore in any sense, but it's more like just the difference in how it like utilizes folklore compared to when we talked about the Wicker Man, which felt like more of that push and pull of a sort of like the indigenous folklore versus a sort of outsider, more mainstream belief system. And that's maybe, I kind of liked how it balanced all of those elements together. I mean, it's super fucking bleak, like you said, like this idea that a curse can't end, you know, you can sort of posit generational traumas and can't end. Like, that's fucking bleak. And I don't think it's necessarily true, but it's more, why does it need a resolution necessarily? I mean, if we're talking about like traditional narrative structures, sure, it needs a easy conclusion maybe, but I don't know, I don't think it necessarily ruined it for me, the end.
Returning to Adam Scoville, who says that folk horror often creates its own folklore, I think this is a key example, kind of what we touched on with the Wicker Man episode as well, where the concept of folklorism is something that is just created or fabricated in its own self. It may be based off of like real local superstition or something, but then it's everybody else's interpretation of that which makes it like the kind of scary thing. Like, you know, essentially they skin people, they skin Dinny, and they attempt to skin Maya because of, you know, the new puppet master who's told them that that would break the curse. They have absolutely no reason to believe that it would break the curse, but everyone kind of jumps on the bandwagon. So I think like that's the kind of terror, is that like the idea of like twisted folklore in order to, you know, serve a purpose. And I And there was like an interesting article review, which was Rezano Nuwara, which for the Jakarta Post said that this movie is a social critique about the dangers of unquestioned higher authority. The film's deeper thesis operates more as a study and a very deft allegorical portrait of the society in which we live, a society in which people blindly do anything their leaders tell them, even if it means having to face a life or death situation. The film manages to examine the issue of mass hysteria by tragically uncloaking the idea that the sins of the leader can be transferred into the bodies and minds of their followers and future generations without them even knowing, and how anyone in a position of power is capable of violent exploitation and causing many catastrophic events. This film clearly wants us to understand that in times of financial crisis, people will do literally anything just to stay afloat, even if it means risking their life. But above all else, this film not only shows the extreme lengths a desperate person will go to for self-preservation, at its deepest core, the film explores how rage and the desire for revenge can blind one to any sense of decency. That's referring to Maya and, that's referring to the grandmother's character. That kind of grounds the folklore elements for me. It's just the manipulation of a legend into something that like becomes doctrine. And then becomes violent.
This is the only folklore that we are covering where the supernatural elements are confirmed real. In Wicker Man, like there's, and both versions of the Wicker Man, we give no proof that the harvest is better after they do what they do. And so I think that like, that's also something unique, but something that I look for in other folklores is like, the humans are the horrific thing and not the magic. And this one, it's a little bit of both, but the humans did the magic. Same with like Midsommar, like we don't know that like anything besides human goes on there. It just like feels a little supernatural. So I don't know. I thought that was like an interesting part of it, that we so overtly, like the body horror is so overtly tied to the magic. And then like people are like offing themselves and stabbing each other. But the body horror element of this, the image that will stick with me forever is when they sling her tits over that clothesline. Y'all, I watched that scene on the train, and when that smack of the thing, the sound of it hits, I audibly gasp, and the man next to me was like, huh? And he like looks over at my phone, and I had to like tuck it behind me first.
That was quite shocking. I forgot about that. Yeah, but that and like the seeing a skinless baby and then also watching it drown, was, it didn't hold back. I was like, damn. So Rebecca Sanders for Horror Obsessive said that Empedocor is rooted in the victimization of women and children. Not necessarily in a way that this is like overdone or fetishized, as she says, but it is almost like intolerable in the sense that it's shocking. This is me paraphrasing, by the way. And then they go on to say, so the theme of violence submerged in the village's participation in a weiyang, combined with the subtext of injustice and violence enacted against women and children, leads me to interpret the film as a commentary on the way that anti-feminism is embedded in Indonesian traditionalism. Now, I don't know enough about like sexism in Indonesia to really comment on that, but I do think that there were comments in the film, like for example, the pregnant villager who comes to Maya's aid, she says there's a threat that like the two male villagers do certainly threaten to rape her at one point, and she like fends them off by like holding a knife to her own throat, and that essentially just leads them to being like, damn, you crazy, and like leaving the house, which I was like, wow. But also the fact that she's like, Maya says, come with me, like, leave the village with me. And she says, it doesn't matter where I go, like, my life will be the same.
I don't know how true that is. Like, maybe they'd keep having skinless babies, but, like, no one is trying to leave. I don't know.
Oh, that was the other thing that I take on the chin. But I was like, how, why are so many of you pregnant right now?
It opening with their conversation about, they're like, considering getting into sex work and just, you know, making sure they're not too, what is it, violent or big. I know it was meant to like really quickly introduce like them as friends, but I think it is quite telling that that's like the topic of conversation. And then even like when, you know, the best friend is, she thinks the two men are like trying to rape her and they're actually, you know, wanting to kill her for the sacrifice. But it does, it like appears in like pivotal moments.
Sexual violence is certainly shaping the film. And then in an interview for Yahoo, the director said, like, the social and political issues facing Indonesia kind of helped sculpt the tale. So I think, like, I mean, I don't know what issues he was specifically referring to, but I think given that sexual violence, even with the grandmother's character and her past, kind of shape and sculpt the story, you might say that it might be a kind of a commentary on that. But again, I wouldn't know enough IRL examples of it, of like, you know, prominent cases in Indonesia to really speak on it. But it seems to be an issue that's being flagged in this film. Thank you for listening to the Monstrous Feminine podcast, produced and hosted by Zeba Aurora, Taya Burnett, Mila F., and Louisa Johnson. Big thanks also go to Sebastian Pizarro for our wonderful theme music. Be sure to follow us on Instagram, SoundCloud, and Spotify at the Monstrous Feminine Podcast and on Twitter at the Monfem Pod. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and follow us on TikTok at the Monstrous Feminine Pod for podcast clips and more fun. All information can be found on our website, www.themonstrousfemininepodcast.com. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Brooms up, witches out.